And now the game where after a long and varied career, a person gets quizzed about the one thing they never bothered to learn. It's called Not My Job. A few decades ago, an American drummer living in England joined a guitarist and this singer with one name that no one remembers. They formed a band called The Police and basically provided the soundtrack for the 1980s. Since then, Stuart Copeland has scored movies, theater performances, and even occasionally gotten that old band together again. Stuart Copeland, welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Well, thank you very much.
So just to get this situated, for those of us who remember The Police so well, in that band, you were the drummer, of course. Mm-hmm. Was it like a Beatles thing where like there was the cute one, the smart one, the dreamy? Did you have a nickname?
No, none of us were smart. It was like the dumb one, the idiot, and the ugly one.
And which one were you, sir?
I think I was all three.
All right. And let's go into your background. I always assume that rock and roll stars always have scrappy upbringings on the streets.
Yes, the hard streets of Beirut, Lebanon, as a matter of fact, which is pretty hard scrabble.
It is. You grew up in Beirut.
Yeah.
And was this because your parents were working there?
Yes, I was a Diplo brat. My daddy was a spy.
He was?
Absolutely. He was fighting the Cold War for you and me.
How long were you in Beirut? When was this? It was like the 50s,
I was pretty much over there until about 15. Then my father's cover was blown, and he packed his family out of Dodge and sent me to boarding school in England.
Boarding school in England. Well, this is a very typical story for an American rock and roll star, don't you think?
Join the club.
Yeah, gosh.
Stuart, when you were little, did you know your dad was a spy?
No, I didn't find out until I was in college in California.
How did that conversation go? Oh, he wrote a book.
I literally found out about it on the liner notes of my father's book.
Really?
I've been kind of whispering on at school. You know, my brother Miles came home one day and said, "Dad, is it true you're a spy?" And he looks at him hard, and he says, "Son, who wants to know?"
Whoa. So how do you go from being this kid in this boarding school in England to one of the three members of basically the biggest rock band of the 1980s?
Of London in 1977. That was pretty hard scrabble too, the punk revolution.
You were in the midst of that whole sort of punk thing coming
out? We were a couple years too old for it, Stingo and I. We were actual professional musicians. We were about 24.
Did you just call your collaborator Stingo?
Yeah.
Was that his original?
That's one of the nicer things that I call him.
Obviously, you know, the Police became enormously huge. I you couldn't turn on a radio around 1982 without hearing your songs.
Was it ever tricky having that be your band name legally, where you'd go to a hotel and be like, "Hello, we're the Police," and they'd be like, "Here's $5,000.
The party's ruined. You know, we arrive at a party. You know, we're in some town. Hey, someone's throwing a party. Come on down." We go down to the party, and we arrive, and we can hear the sound of toilets flushing.
Just out of curiosity, how did you guys pick that name for yourself?
I actually started with the name of Expletive the Police. I've got my diaries from that period. I've got all the accounts of what we paid for the PA, how much we paid for the curry dinner, and I've got a list of band names.
Really?
Each one lamer than the other.
Was it like
Heavy Artillery, Teeth Attack, London Teeth. I was into teeth for some reason. Teeth. You know, the Jaws of Hell.
Dentists.
The Mounties.
The Mounties would have been awesome.
Well, we didn't have any other law enforcement imagery. It was mostly teeth.
Teeth. And you went with, ironically, with an on-tooth name. I don't want to, I mean, obviously, you know, the Police broke up some many years ago, and you've done a lot of things. Sting went off, of course, to have a pretty well-known solo career as a singer. You put out some solo records, and you had some other bands, but you've, would you say, primarily been composing? You've done a lot of film scores.
Yeah, that's what I did. I had 20 years before The Mast as a Hollywood film composer.
And you did such classic films that we all remember as Highlander 2, The Quickening.
Hey, I did some good movies, too.
You did the score to Talk Radio, right?
Yes.
I thought it was a great movie, and I haven't seen it since the, I guess, 1990 or whenever it came out. In my memory, the closing credits involved a piece of music for Touchtone Phone.
My most popular song that I didn't write.
Oh, you didn't write that one? Okay.
No.
It's not on the soundtrack.
So it's like somebody playing a Touchtone
Phone?
That's
your best track. Oh, my favorite track of yours was,
it wasn't my favorite, but it's not on the soundtrack.
That's very kind of you to say so now.
And I love that. No one talks that way to Mike Birbiglia.
I'm sorry. If I thought it was you, Mike, I never would have.
No,
that.
No. You're being teased. You are a professional rock and roll drummer. You were a drummer for one of the great rock bands of all time. Please be truthful with us. Do you hate drum solos too, right?
I played two in my career. One was on the Letterman Show.
Yeah.
The other was on the Serengeti in Africa in a cage surrounded by hungry lions, which was a scene for my film, The Rhythmatist.
Did the lions do what the rest of us do with drum solos and turn around and go get a beer?
No, they did not.
What did they do?
They had been starved for a few days so as to be photogenically aggressive. The cage that I was playing in was festooned with steak, and the only thing was that these ones here came running right up to the thing, and they're grabbing at the cage, and then I started playing my drums, and then they ran away. And so, to get the shot, I had to pretend to hit the drums and not actually hit them because they'd all go running off again. So they went off, but they'd come back pretty quick for the meet, and they'd be yanking at the cage, and one of them got his paw under the cage and his talon stuck into the machine head on the front of the bass drum and was pulled at the thing. It started to go weird. That was the other drum solo I played in my career.
That's when it started to get weird? I'm starting to feel like this story is like a drum solo.
Stuart Copeland, we are delighted to talk to you.
That was...
I'm moving
that
on.
That was Adam Felber. Adam, that was very funny, I thought. But I thought it was a little offensive.
I was a little over the line there, no doubt.
Okay.
No doubt.
Well, Stuart Copeland, what a delight to talk to you. But we have asked you here to play a game...
Yes.
Stuart Copeland, we have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
You have the right to wonder what the heck I'm doing.
You are in the band The Police, of course, but what do you know about the real police? We're going to ask you three questions about questionable police tactics, and if you answer two of them right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice on the home answering machine. Carl, who is musician Stuart Copeland playing for?
Stuart is playing for Peter Jansen of New Haven, Indiana.
All right. Peter, I'm here for you.
All right, here
Let's
we go, Stuart.
Go, buddy.
All right, Stuart, here we go. In 2011, an undercover sting, run by the New York Police Department, went terribly wrong. Why? Was it A, before going to the steam room with the suspects, the lead undercover officer forgot about his NYPD Forever tattoo? Was it B, they set up a fake barbershop to lure crooks, but the policeman/barber did a terrible job cutting hair? Or C, the cop who met the suspects kept trying to crack up the guys listening back in the van by making fart noises into his hidden body mic.
Let's go to the last one.
That is a great story. It'd be funny. But in fact, it was the barbershop is what happened. They set up a barbershop, and they had a cop cut hair who didn't know how to cut hair.
Well, that's pretty good.
So
nobody
came back to the barbershop, including the other undercover cops.
Right, yeah, who all looked like hell.
It was a disaster. All right, you still have two more chances.
Wasn't half as bad as the plastic surgery clinic.
Oh, that'd be terrible. Next question. Another group of NYPD officers arrested two suspicious youths on a drug charge for possession of what? A, some Jolly Rancher candies. B, a jar of Guy Fieri's donkey sauce, or C, a rusty ShamWow?
Well, I am unfamiliar with all three of those things, which equips me perfectly to make a choice. I am going to go with number two.
I like your logic, but it was in fact the Jolly Rancher candies. The arresting officer thought they were crystal meth.
Oh, man.
Okay, here is your last question. A Tennessee cop got into trouble last August when he fired his service weapon. For what reason? A, to signal the start of a Pinewood Derby race for 8-year-olds, B, to knock his lost Frisbee out of a tree, or C, to keep a wild turkey from pooping on his cruiser.
He got fired for any of those things?
Well, he was disciplined for doing these things.
All right.
He was not fired.
Okay, number one.
You're going to go with the Pinewood Derby, that he started a Pinewood Derby race for 8-year-olds, little balsa wood cars, and he fired his gun in the air to start it. It was the turkey. Now, in his defense,
scores his own conversation.
I love it. In his defense, the guy says, look, I wasn't trying to hit the turkey. It was just a warning shot. But they said, you can't fire your weapon to scare a bird off your police cruiser. They reprimanded him. Carl, how did Stuart Copeland do on our quiz?
Not too well, Peter. He had no correct answers out of three choices.
Stuart Copeland is one of the founding members of the Police, as well as being an acclaimed composer for film and theater. He's re-edited version of the classic silent film Ben-Hur, A Tale of Crisis, premiering at the Virginia Arts Festival on April 19th. Stuart Copeland, what fun to talk to you. Thank you so much. Bye-bye now.